is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome Joseph Umeyer, the executive director of Secure Free Society. Joseph and I will turn to several countries in Latin America. This is the New World Report. That are either unknowns at this point about the turmoil or promising countries in Latin America. Our colleague of more than a year and a half, Senator Maria Fernanda Cabal of the Colombian legislature, Bogota, is turning to the campaign season for an election that will be held in the spring, late winter, spring of 2022. So while we cheer Maria and miss her, she is a politician, and it's time to campaign. We turn to Cuba initially because this is the sharp end of the stick. Joseph, a very good day to you. I read from Reuters' report within these last hours. The foreign ministers of the United States and 20 other countries condemned mass arrests in Cuba and called for full restoration of internet access in the island nation that has recently been rocked by political unrest. The joint statement was issued by the governments of Austria, Brazil, Colombia, Croatia, Cyprus, Czech Republic, Ecuador, Estonia, Guatemala, Greece, Honduras, Israel, Latvia, Lithuania, Kosovo, Montenegro, North Macedonia, Poland, Republic of Korea, Ukraine, along with the United States. The statement said in part, democracies around the world are coming together to support the Cuban people, calling on the Cuban government to respect Cubans' demands for universal human rights. That was voiced by the Secretary of State of the United States, Antony Blinken. First measure is a number of these countries have been or know what it is to be under the boot of a non-transparent tyrant. That is certainly the case in Cuba these days. Do you measure that gathering together these voices will move the story for the Havana government, or is it comfortable being isolated? Good day to you, Joseph.
Good day, John. Well, I think in some ways it's obviously helpful because it amplifies the narrative, which is the correct narrative, that the protests in Cuba are not just about the vaccines or food scarcity, that the protests in Cuba is a call for liberty by the Cuban people. The people of Cuba who have had been basically faced with the harshest repression and the longest repression in Latin America for 62 years. But I think this is now starting to become a game of external support, John. Good, you know, lists and rhetoric and solidarity, that's great. But if the Cuban people don't get tangible external support in ASAP, I'm not sure that they're going to be able to move past the Cuban regime. The Cuban regime is getting external support. They're already getting external support from Mexico. They're getting some external support from Venezuela. And I think what we're going to see in the near future, they're going to start to get external support from their like-minded allies such as Russia, China, and potentially even Iran. Now, so one could ask, what can those external actors do for the Cuban regime? Well, they can send them financial abilities and technological abilities to enhance their repressive apparatus. So unless we actually help the Cuban people with some tangible form, whether it's logistics, communications, intelligence, or other, then the acts of solidarity are great, but they might not be good enough.
We have this from these last days. Protesters in Washington want President Biden to do more to pressure the regime. Lead graph. As thousands of anti-regime protesters gathered outside the White House just before midnight, this is within these last hours, to mark the 26th of July with a candlelit vigil, Alex Perez and Chris Cruz stood off to the side and smiled at the scene. These are two young people watching the protesters. The diaspora, the Cuban diaspora, is extremely powerful, emphasize extreme in the United States, has been for many decades. Members of Congress, a prominent member of the Senate, I would say, someone we can associate with all of these issues weighing upon the President of the United States. Is that possibly a useful tool here that the Biden administration can move farther because of political pressure from both sides of the aisle?
Well, it is, John, if the Biden administration, if the White House will use it. As it appears right now, at least from what I've been hearing, they're only reaching out to one aspect of the Cuban American community, which are the Cuban Americans that the Obama administration had worked with to be able to rekindle diplomatic relations and open up commerce and trade with Cuba. From what I understand, the White House has not reached out to prominent Republican lawmakers that are Cuban Americans, such as Senator Marco Rubio or Congressman Lincoln Diaz-Balart or a new Congresswoman, Maria Villa-Salazar. And I think that they need to build a bipartisan approach to this situation. The majority of the Cuban exile, the Cuban American community, both in Florida and New York and other places, is largely in favor of being able to take measures against the regime. So I don't know why they wouldn't reach out to these important aspects of the diaspora. And to that, I'm going to add one more point, John, which I think is this is an important point that a lot of the listeners aren't focusing on. But the team that the Biden administration has in place right now, and granted, they don't have their entire team in place because they're still waiting for confirmations from the Senate. But the current Latin America team that's in place in the White House and the Defense Department and other places are largely some of the same people that favored the previous Obama administration policy of reopening diplomatic and economic relations with Cuba with no concessions, with zero concessions. So their premise for a lot of what's going into this current approach to Cuba with the uprising, their premise is this is an opportunity to open up trade and talks with Havana and not look at severe pressure mechanisms could allow the Cuban people to achieve their goal, which is to displace the regime. So they're looking at this as a way to open up talks with Cuba, not as a way to remove the Cuban regime, not by the United States, but remove the Cuban regime by the Cuban people, who that's what they're really trying to do.
Repeatedly, Joseph, I've read in many reports over these last days the explanation for the extreme poverty in Cuba. The lack of medicines, for example, simple medicines in the hospitals outside of Havana, is the embargo. I've read at the same time that the embargo does not include foodstuffs or medicines. However, again and again, the embargo is pointed to by people in the United States, but people in Europe as the root of the disorder. Is that accurate, Joseph, in your measure?
No, that is one of the oldest and falsest narratives that exist with the whole foreign policy with Cuba. You know, a lot of people, this is the Cuban regime's talking points essentially, but they've been amplified in all kinds of academic circles and other places where they say that the main reason that Cuban people are poor is because the United States has imposed what they call a blockade or an embargo against the island. And that's, frankly, that's distorting what really is the reality. The blockade or the embargo only is against the Cuban regime. It's not against the Cuban people. In fact, the United States has different kinds of trade with the Cuban people in agriculture. They have travel. They have tourism with Cuba, but they have it in a limited way because the Cuban regime controls a lot of the levers of the island. And that's not to mention the fact, John, this is the biggest way you dispel that myth, is Cuba is not prohibited from trading with any of the other countries around the world. It's just the United States. They're not prohibited from trading with Mexico. They're not prohibited from trading with their Caribbean partners. They're not prohibited from trading with Europe. And the reason that none of these other countries have invested heavily into Cuba is not because of the embargo. The reason they have not invested heavily into Cuba is because there's nothing to invest into. The Cuban government, the Cuban economy has been repressed so that there is no innovation, there is no creation, and there is no production. So if you're a businessman from any part of the world, to put your money and your capital into Cuba is just to potentially and probably lose that capital. That's why there hasn't been any trade with Cuba. It has nothing to do with the embargo.
In a conversation in these last days with Roseanne Lake, who is the Cuban correspondent for The Economist magazine, I learned that, and you've commented on this over time, I just hadn't translated, Joseph, that the support that Russia gave and then the support that Venezuela gave have been withdrawn. Why that's important is not just the oil that comes from Venezuela or the attention tourism that comes from Moscow. Both those places were sources of hard currency. That's the profound challenge for the Cuban regime. They lack hard currency. They don't have the income of dollars that they needed, especially with the pandemic cutting out all tourism. So without dollars, the regime cannot prosper, no matter whether the embargo is lifted or not. Is that a correct understanding? It's the currency that is missing.
No, that's correct, John. Cuba has a hard time paying for things. And I mean, the Cuban regime has a hard time paying for things because over and above the sanctions, they just have a shortage of hard currency that they can use that is fungible enough to be able to pay for exports and to pay for imports and to pay for external commerce. One country I would look into, and I agree, the special period that Cuba went under after the Soviet Union, you can equate that to this sort of special period they're going under now with the kind of the economic implosion of Venezuela. But one country I would encourage the listeners to pay attention to is Mexico, because I think that's where the Cuban regime is going to look for getting its not just its currency support, but also its external humanitarian support. In fact, the Mexican Navy is set to arrive soon into Cuba with all kinds of humanitarian shipments of food, supplies, and other. So they're also going to look to become an external supporter of the Cuban regime. And I think this is very telling for the foreign policy and the politics of Andrés Manuel López Obrador.
I mentioned one more detail that we've had in the last week. The U.S. has imposed economic sanctions on the head of Cuba's military response to the crackdown. The sanctions announced by the Treasury Department targeted Alvaro Lopez Miera, Cuba's defense minister, for, quote, serious human rights abuses in connection with the protests, as well as the Black Berets, a unit of the Interior Department that was deployed to curb the unrest. Those Black Berets, are those the same bully, bad actors we see in Venezuela and in other parts of Latin America, wherever Cuban foreign policy is interested? Or is this a different unit, and state security and Black Berets are two different people?
They're a similar unit, John. They're not exactly the same. The ones you see externally that go to Venezuela and other parts of the region to be able to help their allies quell protests are called the Black Wasps, which they're mostly part of the armed forces. The Black Berets are part of the Interior Ministry, and they're specifically designed for this mission, for to repel and to repress the protests that are happening inside Cuba. But they're very related. The tactics, the operational abilities are very, very close. And as far as the sanctions that were named by the White House, by the Department of Treasury, this is fine. This is good. I think it's a good direction to start moving to be able to create punitive actions for the human rights violators in Cuba. But let's not be mistaken. This is not a new action. You got to remember the Trump administration sanctioned the Ministry of Interior as a whole in January of this year. And these are essentially just derivative authorities from that. So basically, they're sanctioning someone that's already sanctioned. And so this is more of a naming than a sanctioning in that respect. And so I don't think it causes or expands that much more of a pressuring mechanism when these are people that are already designated by different kinds of authorities by the U.S. government.
I'm speaking with Joseph Umar, the executive director of Secure Free Society. This is the New World Report. We're turning to Brazil next. There's an old politician who's a new politician in the field to return to the presidency in Brazil. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.